All right. Next, I would like to introduce David N. Lewis, who probably doesn't need a big introduction. Most of us know him as Uncle Dave. He's been an ARSC member since 1999 and has presented at several ARSC conferences since his first talk given in Santa Barbara in 2001 on the subject of obscure band leader Harry Spindler. Lewis ran the underground record label Hospital Records out of Cincinnati in the 1980s and has had a long presence in public radio, appearing in years-long programs on WAIF Cincinnati and WCBN University of Michigan Ann Arbor. He worked as a classical music buyer for West Coast Tower Records and Virgin Megastore locations in the 1990s and spent a decade as an editor for the All Music Guide. Today, he presents monthly lectures at the Public Library of Cincinnati and Hamilton County on topics relating to the music and recording industry in the Ohio Valley, and is an historian and producer for WVXU, the NPR affiliate in Cincinnati. His radio piece on band leader Earl Fuller won an Excellence in Journalism Award from the Society for Professional Journalists. He is going to be presenting along with Rebecca Forstie, who is new to ARSC, but already has reviewed a book for the recent ARSC Journal. Her work has also appeared in Midwest Poetry Review, Owen Wister Review, and Rose Red Review, with work forthcoming in Form Quarterly. She has previously collaborated with David Lewis in researching and presenting talks on Hal Kemp, Mamie Smith, Una Mae Carlisle, Earl Fuller, Grandpa Jones, and Bob Roberts. She continues work on a project examining the lives of 19th century showmen Charles Barney Hicks and Nick Roberts. So today we have I May Be Crazy, But I Ain't No Fool, The Legacy of Funny Man Ragtime Bob Roberts. So David and Rebecca.
Thank you. Before we begin, we'd like to express our thanks to the following.
PowerPoint.
Yes, we do need our PowerPoint, don't we? How do I move from here? I'll read while we're working this out. Our thanks to Ryan Barna, Steve Kempel of the Cincinnati Public Library, Tim Graychick, Alan Sutton, and the late Jim Walsh. Some of the audio you'll hear comes from the University of California Santa Barbara's Cylinder Project and the Library of Congress's National Jukebox. Between these sources, one may encounter dozens and dozens of recordings of Bob Roberts. And I think this will get us to full screen. Well, maybe. Okay, Bob Roberts was a pioneer in most of the things he tried. Ragtime composer, recording artist, stand-up comedian, and early radio comic. Vital to an understanding of ragtime Bob and his career is some knowledge of his father, Nick Roberts, a nationally famous performer and promoter within the milieu of the 19th century. Here to bring us the story of Bob and Nick Roberts, please welcome Rebecca Forstie.
Good morning. Bob Roberts' father, Nicholas D. Roberts, also known as Nick and N.D. and sometimes styled Colonel Roberts, was a vivid and fascinating character, well known on stages across America in the decades immediately following the Civil War. His career was varied and thrilling, with a few shady and dubious episodes tossed in. To tell all there is to tell about Nick would take a lot more time than we have available today, so I'm going to just give you a few highlights. And hold on. There we go. Nick was born in 1841 in Germany, and he came to the United States in 1848. The first record found of him is of his enlistment in the Union Army from Ohio in October 1st, 1862. As early as 1867, newspaper advertisements show that Roberts was the agent for Newcomb's Minstrels. He was also an agent for other minstrel troupes and performed as a minstrel. He became friends with Charles Barney Hicks, who also managed minstrel shows. By the 1870s, Roberts was working as an agent and manager for such agents as magician Herman the Great. The 1870s also saw Roberts tour with the first of his pantomime troupes, Jack and Jill, and then his greatest success, Humpty Dumpty. His pantomime troupes capitalized on the success of the Humpty Dumpty made popular by George Lafayette Fox, who became incapacitated following an accident in 1875. Roberts recruited performers and even a set designer from Fox's troupe. Similarly, Fox had based his own act on the role earlier made popular by Joseph Grimaldi with such success that his name became a synonym for clown. Later in his career, Roberts managed theaters and worked as an advance agent for the John Robinson Circus. He was also the manager of The Count of Monte Cristo, starring James O'Neill, who was Eugene O'Neill's father, and the black vaudeville show A Rabbit's Foot. Nick Roberts and Augustine Claire Zahn were married in Cincinnati, Ohio, in July of 1870. 9 months later, on April 21st, 1871, their firstborn son, Robert S. Roberts, later to record as Bob Roberts, was born. Robert's birth year has been reported as 1879 by some biographers and by his wife, Catherine, on his death certificate. Since Catherine was born in 1888, Roberts may have wanted her to believe that he was closer to her age than he actually was. My research has consistently indicated that it is astonishingly common for adults to lie about their age. Roberts may also have felt that posing as a younger man was beneficial to his entertainment career. So this is the 1892 census, where we have Roberts living in New York with his parents and his brother, and he's listed as 22, which is actually a little older than he probably would have been. But if he had been born in 1879, he would have been 12 years old and probably wouldn't have been able to get a job as a bookkeeper, as it says he had. 1900 census shows that he's 29 years old, working in a music store, still living with his parents, and his birth date is given as 1871, April of 1871. 1910 census from Manhattan shows 38-year-old Roberts working as an artist in a theater and living with his mother and his brother. Nick had passed away in 1905. The family lived at 204 West 111th, which is just north of Central Park. The building now on this spot was built in 1910. That's what it looks like, and probably that was where he lived, but I don't know that for sure. So that's the evidence that I found a lot more evidence for that 1871 date than the 1879 date. I also have this newspaper account from November 30th, 1877, that not only provides support for that 1871 birth date, but also for his having appeared in his father's shows. It says a little six-year-old boy, and if he was born in 1871, he definitely would have been 6 years old in 1877. He performed as the automaton soldier, and there's a picture of little boys dressed up as soldiers that came from an advertising card for the Nick Roberts Humpty Dumpty show. And there's a slide missing here. But there's also a program that is from 1881 that shows a Master Robbie performing as a newsboy in one of the Humpty Dumpty shows. And that is all I have for you. Any questions before I hand it over to Uncle Dave? No? Thank you.
Thank you. And yeah, there's another appearance.
That's the slide there in the wrong order. That's the one that that had him, and then the programs must be after that. They got mixed up. Yeah, there's the program. Sorry about that. That's a 1881 performance of the Humpty Dumpty on the second page. The print's kind of small, but there is a newsboy that's played by Master Robbie, who I think is Bob Roberts. And there you go, sorry.
Yeah, well, we also have the original program here if you'd like to look at it later. Few have connected Ragtime Bob with Robert S. Roberts, a composer credited with two instrumental rags published in Cincinnati in 1897. His first piece, The Pride of Bucktown, is the second or third ragtime piece to appear in print in the United States. Let's have track one, please. Please pardon the chiptune. Although Bob Roberts made about 500 recordings, he is not known to have recorded anything of his own, not even his 1900 hit, I'm Certainly Living a Ragtime Life, which would seem a natural choice for the composer as singer. When ragtime ace and public television icon Max Morath moved from Colorado to New York City in 1963, Roberts' then-forgotten hit became a key element in Morath's off-Broadway show. Next track, please.
Got more trouble than I can stand ever since ragtime has struck the land. Never saw the like in all of my days. Everybody's got the ragtime craze. Stood it just as long as I could. At last I got it, and I got it good. First I didn't want any in mine, but now I'm right in line. I got a ragtime dog and a ragtime cat, a ragtime piano in my ragtime flat. I got ragtime clothes from hat to shoes. I read a paper called the Ragtime News. I got ragtime habits and I talk that way. I sleep in ragtime and rag all day. Got ragtime troubles with my ragtime wife. I'm certainly living a ragtime life.
Max breaks into Creole bells there, sort of as an aside. All right, so I'm the one holding it up. Okay. The recording that I personally believe is Bob Roberts' best and most influential is one of his last, Ragtime Cowboy Joe, made for Victor in 1912. This was his last hit, and it's an excellent way to access Roberts' general style, his voice, and the kind of material that distinguished him as Ragtime Bob to the public. Next track, please. Whoops. Let's try the one after that. Maybe we've got them in the wrong sequence.
Start a war, the wise men know his 44. Make men dance for fair. He always sings ragged music to the saddle as he swings. Back and forward in the saddle on a horse. That a syncopated gaiter than the such a funny meter to the roll of his repeater. How they run when they hear his gun, because the western folks all know he's a highfalutin, rootin', shootin' son of a gun from Arizona, ragtime cowboy Joe. He always sings raggy music to the cattle as he swings back and forward in the saddle on a horse. That is syncopated gaiter than such a funny meter to the roll of his repeater. How they run when the hair is gone, because the Western folks all know. He's a highfalutin, rootin', shootin' son of a gun from Arizona, ragtime cowboy Joe.
While ragtime cowboy Joe may be his most lasting contribution, it wasn't his only hit, and perhaps was not even his best-known song in his time. That might be Everybody Works But Father, written by J. Fred Helf and Jean Havez, and published by Fred Hager. I say might, as it appears that he only recorded it on Edison Amberall, and it was never reissued. Nevertheless, when Ragtime Bob's name is invoked in modern times, this is usually identified as his big song, and we might want to go one track back.
That beating carpet, father said, he simply was immense. We took our parlor carpet out and hung it on the fence. Then mother said, now beat it, dear, with all your might and main. But father, he just beat it back to the fireside again. Everybody works but father, and he hangs round all day. Sweet in front of the fire, smoking his pipe of clay. Mother takes in washing, and so does Sister Anne. Everybody works at our house but my old man.
Incidentally, one of the writers of this song, Gene Havez, later moved to Hollywood and worked as a gag man for Buster Keaton and Harold Lloyd. One reason this song was so successful is that it was topical. The first decade of the 1900s was marked by a recession caused by a stock market crash shortly before Theodore Roosevelt became president. It was further deepened by the panic of 1907. Then, as now, people at the bottom of the economic ladder got so discouraged in looking for work that they just gave up. And much as past political situations in England resulted in the Mother Goose rhymes we still recite to our children, songs like Everybody Works But Father have survived in the repertoire of tunes our grandmothers have sung us. Many of Bob Roberts' songs deal with money, not sharing it, not squandering it, or squandering it, wasting it, and losing it. Some examples are, my name is Morgan, but it is not JP, and you must think I'm Santa Claus. Another song, And the World Goes On, warns that you shouldn't bother to mourn the money you have lost because it's not coming back. In 1900, as Rebecca has discovered, Bob Roberts was working in a music store in Cincinnati. It may have been this music store, the Wurlitzer Music Store on 4th Street. If so, then it would have been here that Bob Roberts would have first had access to recording equipment, as Wurlitzer bought out the assets of the Ohio Phonograph Company, which Edison closed. It may have been just when he went to New York City and first recorded for Columbia, he might have been able to give them a cylinder he already had. All of Robert's earliest Columbia cylinders were remakes of songs by other artists. And since the numbers did not change on the cylinders and the artists were not listed in catalogs, we don't know when his first records were made. This is a page from the German Gramophone catalog of 1900. And as you can see, there's a number, there's a selection, there's no artist listed. That was just the convention of the time. Jim Walsh proposed a date of 1901. We know that Bob Roberts was there. Alan Sutton puts forward a date of 1903. Tim Graychick suggests 1902 as a viable alternative. I've compiled my own discography, and I think that Jim Walsh was right. It's 1901. Roberts began recording discs for Victor in 1903 and with Edison in 1904. In the years 1903 to 1905, Roberts would record a selection on cylinder and 7 and 10-inch discs for Columbia, then take the same piece and record it on 7 and 10-inch discs for Victor, essentially recording everything he did 5 times. Columbia had a number of client labels for department stores that it serviced, and Roberts' Columbia records also appeared on labels like Oxford, Harvard, Standard, United, Busy Bee, Marconi, Lakeside, Silvertone, Aretino, and many, many others. Victor and Columbia both eventually abandoned 7-inch records, and Columbia stopped making cylinders in 1907, in which case Bob Roberts went on to the cylinder company Columbia was distributing, which was Albany Indestructible. He made a lot of cylinders for them and some for the Cleveland-based firm U.S. Everlasting. His recording career began to slow down around 1910 as he was picking up more live dates. He made his last Victor and Columbia records in 1912 and his last issued Edison record in 1913. Newspaper articles refer to his act of that time as a monologuist, which in 19th century parlance meant an artist who recited poetry and excerpts from plays. But newspapers that Rebecca has reviewed seem to indicate what he was doing was a kind of stand-up comedy. And perhaps that's what he was trying to pitch when Thomas Edison made this note about a Bob Roberts test in 1915. And the old man commented that, no, can't interpret, can't sing. From 1914 to 1917, Bob Roberts made a bunch of records for the Rex Talking Machine Company of Philadelphia. This was a vertical label that didn't infringe on the patents of the big boys, but you had to have a special machine to play them, and so they weren't very popular. They're pretty rare, and not all of these titles, the Bob titles for this label, have been documented. The musical director at Rex was Fred Hager, who had published Everybody Works But Father and may have known Bob Roberts back in Ohio. And these were Bob's last records, and since he produced 500 records, you figured that his records would be everywhere, like those of Henry Burr and Billy Murray, but they aren't. Also, Bob showed some taste in terms of what he recorded. He did prefer coon songs, which was a popular genre that began in 1903 with the performance in Dahomey with Williams and Walker. He recorded a lot of songs that Burt Williams did, and in some cases, songs that Burt Williams didn't himself record, and also some songs that Roberts got to before Burt Williams did record them. He also recorded pieces by Chris Smith, who wrote Ballin' the Jack, and Ernest Hogan, who introduced the dance, the Pas Mala. Among the other composers he recorded was Theodore Morse, Gene Schwartz, Egbert Van Alstyne, Percy Wenrick, George M. Cohan, Ted Snyder, Harry Von Tilzer, and at the very end of his career, Irving Berlin. And when jazz broke out in 1917, Bob Roberts left New York and went back to Cincinnati to found a pool hall. In 1929, he ended up opening WCKY with a show called Hans and Fritz, which was German dialect humor. He also, in his career, recorded Yiddish and Irish dialect selections. Ironically, one thing that he didn't do very often was use Negro dialect. He sang his coon songs in his regular voice. And what's significant about this is that he was making one baby step towards the milieu of singers like Al Jolson and Bing Crosby, who did not affect the trappings of vaudeville. Well, Jolson a little bit, Crosby not at all. Bob Roberts was on that path. And I think I'm out of time. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. We are out of time, so for this paper, maybe people could ask questions at the end of the session.